Welcome to episode 15 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Imogen Taylor in her studio in Henderson, West Auckland. Imogen has a Bachelor of Fine Arts and a Postgraduate Diploma of Fine Arts from the Elam School of Arts at the University of Auckland. Her work is held in numerous public and private collections, including the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waiwhitu, the Fletcher Collection, and the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki. In 2017, Imogen was the artist in residence at the McCann House, and in 2019 was the recipient of the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship. She is represented by Michael Lett Gallery in Auckland. There are images of the paintings we talk about on the Good Oil Imogen Taylor Instagram post for your reference. In this episode, you'll hear Imogen talk about how she aspires to embody the same qualities that are reflected in the materials that she uses, her celebration of New Zealand regionalism in her practice by applying a drag sensibility to it, her clear appreciation for modernism, wanting to protect illegibility in painting, how heartbreaking she finds parting with work when it leaves the studio. She shamelessly reveals herself to be a colour nerd and not a very good painter. We started by talking about her first exposure and experience of art, the influence of her art book publishing father, and being drawn to Robin White and Rita Angus' work as a child.
Probably through books. Like, art books were pretty consistent in my upbringing. My father was a publisher, published a lot of art books. So, yeah, definitely on pages, which I think is pretty common for a lot of New Zealand artists and is embedded in New Zealand painting, is that we're always mostly looking at kind of international paintings through pages of books. And up until a certain point, most of those paintings were only printed in black and white, which influenced a whole league of painters. I was pretty lucky in that book, New Zealand Contemporary Painters,
that my dad published,
was around a lot. So I was engaging with a lot of paintings by those painters. So there was a lot of colour. It was mostly, I'd say, abstract or like a lot of regionalist work. I remember being really affected by Robin White and Rita Angus and their use of contouring and line work, which as a child, I think you grow up looking at like heavy, thick black lines in comics and drawings. So to see painters utilising kind of linear forms in their work, I was instantly drawn to, particularly Robin White and maybe Don Binney as well. So I think it's kind of cute that those artists, like, kids like those painters. But also, I remember talking to Judy Miller about this, actually, about both of us being kids and being really fascinated by Cubism and learning about Cubism at school and wondering why Cubism resonates with children. And, I mean, there's so many reasons. I could talk for ages about why that might be. But,
Well, why is it in a top-line summary?
I think that kind of alternative perspective work of, like, art is ultimately, it's taught out of children, right? We're all born with a capacity for creativity, and it's really encouraged in kids from an early age to be creative and to draw, to make art. And then at school it starts getting kind of taught out or phased out of a person's life. So kids just have an amazing capacity for seeing, and if you are looking at paintings or drawings that suggest alternative modes of seeing objects or imagery, then kids are kind of instantly going to get it and accept it. So I think maybe it's just that. In some ways, I think kids are more open to viewing art or imagery than maybe adults are. But maybe I'm delusional. I don't know. I would like to think that. I don't have children, so I don't know firsthand, but that was my experience.
Sounds
as a
like
child.
A pretty solid theory to me. With your father publishing some quite famous New Zealand art books, were there artists around as well? I wonder if there were role models almost around because of that publishing work he was doing. So were you encountering artists as well?
I remember meeting several artists. I think the most powerful meeting of an artist was Tony Fomerson, the day that he died. my dad in 1990 took me to the Treaty of Waitangi ceremony on Waitangi because I grew up in Koro Rareka, Russell, so it wasn't far away. And that was when the Queen visited. And I remember sitting on a hill with my dad. I wouldn't have been that old. I think I would have been 4 or 5. And I remember this man, like, climbing up a hill and being terrified of this kind of, like, I wouldn't call him a creature, but that seems too inhumane. But he was, like, I'd never seen a person like that before. And I remember my dad saying, oh, it's Tony Formison. And he sat around with us on the hill for a while we ate our lunch. And then that day, later on, after some time, he died from, I guess, alcohol.
Yeah,
like poisoning or whatever. But there is a really incredible story that I read by an artist who lived in Russell when we were growing up called Mary Isaac, and she studied at, I think, Ilam with Claremont, Formison, those artists. And she was there for the last day of Formison's life, and she's written the most amazing short story about that experience. Which is online. I think it's her daughter has published the short story. But yeah, I think that was, I remember that really clearly. I mean, there were lots of writers, lots of artists of all different kinds, but I don't remember there being an abundance of visual artists because a lot of people had passed away or moved overseas, or because we lived in the Bay of Islands, it was quite
removed.
Yeah, it was a bit removed. There were people around, like Lawrence Aberhart lived in Russell. I was best friend. I was early best friends with his son Ruben. And then Seraphine Pick grew up in Russell, so she worked at my parents' restaurant, and we're really close with her mum Helen Pick, who was also an artist. So Russell, yeah, I just kind of corrected myself. I was thinking it was remote and artists didn't come that way, but artists were living around there. I remember stories of Hundavasa actually being around. Yeah, those are, I probably won't talk about those stories though because they're like quite wild. But yeah, so yes, short answer, yes, I did. Yeah. But I actually had forgotten, so thanks for jogging my memory.
Oh,
yeah.
A pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although it also sounds like your dad was quite influential. Like presumably if he's publishing those books, you know, there had to be, as you say, like, tons of pictures around of paintings. So presumably that seeped into you a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think early on a lot of paintings were, there were actual paintings from those artists, particularly from contemporary New Zealand painters, in the house. But then along the way we needed to sell them so that we could kind of move to Auckland and we could go to school. And so they've, like, long gone. But I remember... Yeah, like Ian Scott painting, and like I think there was a McCann, but I don't even know if it was real. It could have been a fake.
You don't know if it was real?
Yeah. That was like not that uncommon in our house, like to experience forgery. And it's
it was during the fortune.
Maybe another story. Wow, I'm gonna totally like do an interview with you where I just can't even tell stories. But yeah, there was a lot of art. I was really lucky to grow up around art, and I only realised that kind of when I got to art school and met a lot of people that hadn't grown up in households where art, that their parents had art. But in saying that, I think my parents were able to buy art because it was a lot of it. Like, they'd told me the price, and I was like, wow, you got that for $30? Like, and they're like, but there was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
But it was nothing like what it is now. So yeah, books and art were kind of the main thing around when I was growing up.
It sounds almost inevitable if your father was publishing those books that he was, that you were going to end up at Elam or training in the arts in some way, shape or form. So did that feel inevitable when you were a teenager?
I knew that I wanted to be an artist when I was 5. So, yeah, it felt inevitable. But
an artist painter or an artist, a broader idea of creativity?
I think I go between saying painter and artist because drawing has always been my kind of first art form. But I think painting and drawing come together, whereas some people would say that they're really different. But, yeah, I'm mostly a painter-drawer, like... two-dimensional artist, that's what I wanted to be. It came up really quickly in my life that I was good at that. And I remember Dad saying from when I was really young that I would go to Elim and so
is this his daughter realizing his unfulfilled dreams?
A little bit. I think he might have been waiting for one of us to be creative, because there was four of us, so, and I was the youngest.
You were the best bet.
Yeah. But I was good at it at school as well, and won lots of awards and stuff. So
fostered at school by someone?
Yeah, several people who... I remember winning an art prize quite early on, and it was a still life, and we're, you know, all the kids are given a still life of jugs and stuff in front of them, and they each paint them, and I won the art award because I painted all of the stains on the jug, and I made it look just really grotesque. And I think that was always my strength, was like bringing out the kind of grotesque details in life and really running with it. So I never kind of was very good at making things beautiful or idealizing things in art. I would always kind of encourage caricature or failure or the abject. So that, yeah, it's when you know that, it makes a lot of sense to the work that I make now.
Yeah. Were you surprised when you won your first art prize at school?
I think I was. I think I'd only had the encouragement at home, so to have it outside of home was good. But to have those key players early on in my life who encouraged me to do something that wasn't fitting the mould and that was different and wasn't acceptable, I think that was a surprise, yeah.
Painting wasn't your major at Elim, so...
We didn't have majors at Elim then.
Oh.
So they'd gotten rid of the majors the year that I started. You would always do one... The first year would always be broad and you'd do everything, and then you'd go into your department for second, third and fourth, but that degree has changed from 3 years to 4 years, and now it's gone back to 3 years again. So when we were in first year, they were like, well, actually there's no disciplines now, so you'll be doing an interdisciplinary degree. So there wasn't an opportunity to specialise in painting, which was hard. It was really difficult.
Because you wanted to be painting.
I wanted to be a painter, and also when I went to the open day at Elim, they still had the wooden mansions where... Do you remember those? Like
the wooden mansions?
When you went down into the main campus of Elim, there was the Mondrian building, the Fine Arts building, and then over on this, like in the valley, quite close to the motorway, were these wood and brick mansions where they were big old kind of colonial buildings that they'd often have the painting department in. And when I went in, I was like, this is painting, because it was like super grungy and like very like bohemian romantic ideas of painting. But the institution changed so quickly, and when I was there it was going through a really hard time, as I'm sure. I don't think it's changed. I think it's still having a hard time, but they sold the land that was under the mansions to developers, so those went, and then the studio spaces got smaller. They had these different campuses, but they've gotten rid of them over the years. It's a tricky thing. I know, I can see why they have to do it. University has to do it. Like, for how many students are doing those degrees, they require a lot of space, and the space in that part of the city is money. So, sorry, what was the question?
Well, the question was being able to pursue painting at Elim.
Yeah.
You got there eventually. In terms of focusing on it as a discipline?
No, I graduated making video. So I think I got the wrong end of the stick regarding interdisciplinary. I struggled at art school because it was going through this time, and I don't know if it's still the case, where you would come up with a concept first for what you wanted to make art about, and then you would then find the kind of medium that you would use to communicate it. And that's never how I'd worked, and it's not how most people work. I work, and I continue to still work through practicing and then kind of having some ideas in the background that then come in, particularly at the end, in a way of articulating what's happened. But play and practice is really important to me and something that I really protect. But at that time interdisciplinary to me, I took it to mean I can use all of them at the same time. So I'd make like paintings and films and photography and sculpture all together, and it kind of was a mess, but in some way it was a blessing because I was really interested in combining sculpture with painting.
Mm.
And that is still a thread that runs through my work. So I did some painting, but also painting at that time, it was very gatekeepy. So like you'd have the painters, and if you were doing something that remotely resembled more drawing, they'd be like, that's not painting. But when I returned to Elam to do postgrad, it kind of the painting department, or like not that there was a department, but the pedagogy around painting had changed, and it had gone more into this practice-led kind of way of painting. So that's when I had more access to painting, and that's when I focused on it a lot more.
Hmm.
But it was, yeah, they were challenging years at Elam in that I think conceptualism was reigning. So if you didn't have a conceptual practice, it was assumed that all practices were innately conceptual, which in some ways I agree with, but I also think there's space to kind of have more of a formal, like practical, pragmatic approach to art making, and to just kind of trust that conceptual frameworks or like research will come through that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. To jump forward probably just a few years from that show, I think second show at Michael Lett, your dealer. So from 2013, it looked like you'd found your way into what has become, you know, a really recognisable painting language for Imogen Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Was that easy to get to? Like, it looked like the penny dropped somehow from 2013, and the work looks, you know, really recognisable over the course of the last few years, tracing back to that show in 2013.
Yeah, I think a penny did drop, and it was probably finding my way from making collaged paintings to thinking about collage differently. And thinking about, rather than like different surfaces or materials making up a collage, I started to think about, can collage exist within just painted surfaces? And also like, can it exist in the kind of substrate? So I took a huge risk at that time and started painting on Hessian, which again goes back to Fomerson and Claremont and those key players in my upbringing.
It feels like a nostalgic platform,
it was definitely that, yeah. But it took a while to learn how to use that material because it's a difficult material to wrangle, and I don't know if those artists, of course their work is amazing. I had spoken to people working in conservation, and it needs to be primed really well, and it's not archival, and so it took me a while to work out how to kind of wrangle it. But I'm guessing that's what you're talking about, is the shift to Hessian and that kind of more contour, like regionalist glowing kind of work that I started making.
Yeah.
Rather than the content of the work, right?
Yes.
It's the kind of feel of the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially it becoming quite cubist quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, although that first show I had at Michael Lett was quite cubist, but again, was employing collage, was on canvas. So I think, yeah, I mean, God, it feels like the work has been through so many shifts, but the Hessian has remained consistent, and the acrylic paint. But I guess the forms have been the things that have changed the most.
So do you feel like you've got a handle on Hessian now?
Oh, I'm ready to leave it behind. I think this last show that I just had was me trying to ditch it.
And this is Murmurs at Michael
Lett. And it's been really hard because there's still a couple of Hessian paintings in there, but it was me kind of bringing canvas back in to be like, is this okay? Is this good? And people were like, yes. Like, they really responded to it.
Because I noticed looking at that show that there is a mix of supports. There's Hessian and canvas, and there's linen as well, right?
Yeah, yeah, and calico.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So four different supports in one show.
Yeah, I think I've always thought about the substrate being as important as the paint, which kind of is interesting because when you first asked me to do this interview, I was thinking a lot about the good oil, and about hierarchies and painting, and oil kind of being at the top of those hierarchies. And I was almost like, really, you want me? Because I paint in acrylic, and that's polymer, the good polymer. And I think people still look down on acrylic painting, but the thing that people working in acrylic often do is they don't really care about what they're painting on. Mm. And the beauty of acrylic is that it can go on anything.
Yeah.
So whereas oil can't necessarily, or it's, you're running more, you might, there's more risk of it failing with oil, but acrylic is just like, it's so tactile and it's robust, and those are qualities that I aspire to have personally, so it makes sense for the medium to kind of mirror who I am as well. And I'm really impatient and quite I like taking risks and making quick decisions. Not necessarily in life. I think I'm quite chill in life now, but back then I was like, not so much. And acrylic really, it worked for me, and so I've never really ditched it.
Mm.
But I think...
Well, if it ain't broke.
Yeah, well, although sometimes I think it would be nice to have time to, like, do tonal work with oils.
Mm.
But I don't know. Yeah, maybe one day.
Yeah.
I
don't usually ask painters about their sexuality and their experience of it. But for you, your sexuality is quite often front and centre of your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I did want to ask you a few questions about it today.
Sure.
You're fine with that?
Yeah, totally.
And wanted to start with a quote from you. Like, you had said early in your career that in some ways you'd found the art world, like, felt a bit homophobic. And I was wondering, as a result of that, whether you had shied away from making the work that you'd really wanted to, you know, whether that was going to be too overtly, you know, homosexual or queer, and ended up disguising that with themes of abstraction.
Yeah, well, I think the homophobic quotes are probably referring to several things. It kind of would have begun at art school for me when I was making almost exclusively figurative work involving bodies, and I was really into abjection and kind of the uncanny and grotesque. I don't know, there were lots of artists that I was really into who were quite full on at the time, and I was making work accordingly. And I had several tutors who tried to kind of steer me away from that, saying it was kind of too much and it read too quickly, and to kind of slow down the reading, they were encouraging me to replace bodies with forms that were reminiscent of bodies. But so in a way, I didn't realise at the time, I just went with it, but I didn't realise that in a way they were kind of pushing me back into the closet, maybe. And I then essentially kind of coded the work with, I wouldn't say abstraction. I think a good example is that first show at Michael Lett, where I'm using a lot of tubes and these kind of phallic forms. So I think in later years read that as, well, that's kind of quite full on to be an educator and to be discouraging a young queer artist from making work that's addressing their sexuality, and then steering them away from that. And I can see what they were doing, but that then kind of luckily led me down the path towards more abstraction and cubism and modernism. So in a way, I think it worked out well for me because I'm happy with where I am now. I just think things could have been handled a little bit differently. And I think as well as that art school homophobia that happened, or like, maybe it wasn't homophobia, I think it was like lack of encouragement,
right,
by people, by mostly like straight cis men.
So you're thinking about that quite differently now than maybe you were at art school 15, 16, 17 years ago?
Wow, yeah. Yeah, I can understand. I have more compassion for them. I think I was quite, for a while, I was pretty angry that had happened, that it was like a lack of responsibility on their part to see diversity in art practices and to encourage that, which I definitely think is happening now. And there also, art schools are employing a way more diverse range of people in those positions who are directly addressing that in their own practices. But also, I think the homophobia quotes if it's the interview I'm thinking about, it was referring to collections and acquisitions made by public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a really long time to have my work acquired by several public institutions. And maybe the work wasn't great. I don't know. I feel like a lot of it was selling and I was doing well. So I don't think it's that. I think, I mean, the article that the quote came up in was around Auckland Art Gallery and their lack of labelling queerness in the work of artists in the collection who were dealing with those themes. I know that they've adjusted that and they've kind of, they're doing a much better job now. But yeah, I grew up in an art world that was very shy of talking about the private lives of queer artists, even though those artists were talking about it themselves in the work.
Well, you've already talked about not wanting to be weird
yeah.
when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But I mean, it's not an issue. It's not a problem to talk about artists' personal lives and their sexuality.
Mm.
It does feel like a different world because it's now, you know, someone like Frances Hodgkins, whether she was a homosexual or not, she was surrounded by open homosexuals who supported her a lot through her career. And art historians a few years ago felt a real sense of duty to protect her from any sense of queerness around her that artists or other people might be inflicting on her. And I think that is something that we should be way more careful about, because you really want that to be passed on to young queer artists, that oh, don't talk about your personal life, or don't bring that up, it's not cool. Like, it is, it's fine.
Well, a change for the better,
yeah,
right? Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe not comfortable for in the age of Frances Hodgkins, but surely changing for the better now.
Yeah, I think I'm always careful how I talk about artists who that language wasn't around when she was alive. And, you know, someone else like A. Lewis White, I think a lot of people have been like, well, she was a lesbian. I think, oh, I feel cautious to say that. But if the themes and those relationships are in the work, then I feel like we can talk about it.
Which they really are with A. Lewis
White. Yeah. I think everything in saying all of this, and yes, I did experience homophobia in a variety of forms. I still think it was kind of, maybe it was meant to be, because I've ended up, I'm happy with where I am now, and in a way, like, it's a full circle, and I'm returning to abstraction in a way and understanding it differently as not a covering up of content, but I don't think abstraction is a style anymore as much as it is a mode of working, and I think it's a really interesting terrain where we can enact things on a canvas in a really political way without having to kind of illustrate bodies and queerness in that way. It's like, yeah.
Because I was wondering whether you being discouraged from being overt with your queerness at art school, at least, whether it actually had a positive effect of forcing you to discover a creativity or an approach to work that you wouldn't have employed otherwise. So did that happen as a positive byproduct maybe to some latent homophobia or?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think, I mean, I just made do with what I had at the time, and I think, had I not got in there, I just don't think I would still be practicing if I just kept making the work. So in a way, it was, as much as I do not tolerate homophobia, I managed to do well with what I had at the time and opened up a whole lot of worlds and a lot of artists and a lot of communities that I otherwise wouldn't have discovered. But also, I'm really pleased with how the work can operate and speak to a huge diverse range of people, and I think a lot of that is through abstract painting languages. Yeah.
Well, that's the nice thing about your work, is that, you know, we're sitting here talking about homophobia and queerness, but it's sexuality, you know, at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that has been that's still a difficult thing. I feel like I'm constantly juggling, like, painting and my love for painting and making paintings and viewing paintings, but then I'm also, like, trying to inject these politics and this agenda in it. And I just don't know if those two things naturally want to be together. Like,
But you manage it in some paintings sometimes.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I think a painting practice is kind of, in a queer theory practice, really contradictory things.
Mm.
But that's a nice kind of set of problems to work with. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I am a gay person, and I'm interested in trying to imagine what queer art is or it can be. But I still struggle with it, and I'm still lost, and that's a reason to keep painting.
Yeah. And so you've just talked about contradiction, but there's a nice compliment as well in cubism. So I think I've heard you talk about cubism being naturally quite queer.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit, I think I'm blind to this as a heterosexual man, but, you know, what do you mean about cubism being naturally quite queer?
Well, I think it was kind of along the lines of modernism being, like, the history of modernist painting and art making being almost inseparable from queer histories coming up at that time.
Mm.
And I always go back to a painting by Marsden Hartley, which is a kind of multi-plane, faceted work, which is comprised of, I guess, it is really coded with his. He had a lover who was male and who was killed in the war, and so he created this painting that was kind of like a mishmash of his lover's uniform, and it had like his military numbers or whatever, and it's all kind of, it's an abstract cubist painting, but there are like tiny little coded messages hidden in it. And I think at the time he was friendly with Gertrude Stein, who encouraged him to code his same-sex desire into his paintings because Picasso was doing it. And of course Picasso's work is heavily coded because of all of the affairs he was having, so with women, obviously, not men. I wish men, but no. Picasso was so straight,
so,
as far as we know.
It's so aggressively heterosexual, we might say.
Yeah. So I think there were opportunities for a lot of queer artists who are working in that mode to kind of preserve, like, same-sex desire within the paintings without it being destroyed, really.
Mm.
And I went and saw that painting by Marsden Hartley recently, and it was probably like the most heartbreaking painting I've ever seen. It's so desperately sad. Yeah, just the amount of grief that exists in it, and like not so much the grief around his partner dying, but like the inability to like live together as a couple even before the partner was killed. And it still blows my mind that just wasn't a possibility for so many people.
Can you date that painting for me? Presumably it's World War I, World War II.
Yeah, well, I will have to get back to you on that one, actually.
Earlier 20th century.
Yeah. I still think there is, like, a general vibe for me sometimes with a lot of Cubist paintings that there's this kind of camp sensibility about them as well.
Yeah.
This dandyism of that time that really shines through, and I don't think I'm making that up. I think there is, yeah, I think it's a thing, yeah. So that's kind of what I was riffing off when I first started making cubism, was like the camp kind of erotic, like bodily nature of it.
To step you back to your own work in abstraction, did abstraction as a preferred painting expression come first, or was it a response and a way to paint to help disguise or hide your sexuality, you know, as encouraged maybe you were at art school?
Mm. I think, I don't know if it was a disguise. I think it was an opening up of the practice and a challenging, I think I was challenging myself on how to speak and how to communicate with a viewer and how to hold them in the painting for longer, and also how to speak to the history of New Zealand painting. Yeah, I think it was also, I became really invested in process and creating an image that didn't exist in the world before it ended up existing in my paintings. So I think it's really difficult to do that with figuration. Like, I actually think it's impossible, unless I guess it's a combination of different figures and different parts of the painting. Yeah, I don't know if it was a disguise like Hartley, for example. I think having gone through that stuff at art school and being encouraged to essentially code the work, it was then like, okay, how much further can I take this? How can I be a queer artist or a feminist artist but not be overtly saying those things? Will they just eventually seep through anyway?
Well, to that point,
yeah.
Your relationship then with New Zealand art history and regionalism, because I know you're a fan, right?
Huge fan, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has always had a real soft spot in my heart, regionalism. I think we all grow up with regionalist painting around us. And I mean, my fifth form boards, like the biggest, my school C art boards, the biggest influence on those was probably Don Binney. And I went out to Pihar and like made these little paintings that looked like mini Don Binneys. And then when I got to art school, it was like really uncool to look at New Zealand painting, and people were, you know, looking at art on a more global scale. And then after art school, my friends moved overseas and had practices in Berlin and London and New York, and I was still here in Auckland. And so it kind of came in, I guess, when I was working on the Hessian, and I thought, why don't I just go the whole way and start referencing my first love of regionalism? And it came in that way. But then I think years later, I was in a symposium talking to Victoria Wynne Jones, and she brought up this quote about how queer artists kind of work in a way that's similar to drag, like, you know, drag queens. Mm. And drag is something that fascinates me, and I'm a huge fan of drag, and I think it does resonate with me a lot in the way that I will use pastiche or homage to past art movements or artists like Don Binney and or Colin McCann, and I will kind of have these little references in my work, but then it's kind of really exaggerated to a point of it almost being like caricature. And that's a real drag technique, where it's kind of making fun of it, but it's also doing it in a really loving way. Like, it's showing a lot of love for whatever you're making fun of. Which...
Is that why you make the reference to drag? Because it's, you know, it's respecting something, but you're still making fun of.
Yeah, like, it's you're doing it in a way where you're like, I know this is not, for me, with regionalism, I know it's problematic. Like, it's regionalism in New Zealand is heavily linked to Pākehā white male identity, this national identity that I'm always challenging as a queer woman, and thinking about what could queer regionalism be if queer people kind of have a certain responsibility that is attached to decolonization or anti-racism. Like, what can I then bring to a new sense of queer regionalism? But then also, I have a lot of respect for the regionalism that's come before.
They were bloody great paintings.
Oh, they're bloody great paintings, definitely. But it's kind of, yeah, I thought of myself as like, am I essentially like doing drag of Colin McCann?
Someone's got to.
Yeah, and so, yeah, maybe it's that. But yeah, still a lot of respect for it. And I think there's lots of connections between New Zealand regionalism and regionalism, and that was happening in different parts of the world. Like, a lot of South American painters, they had the same kind of modernist artist models who, and then it all kind of trickled into different parts of the world, which I think is really interesting as well.
Is that why you're bringing, you know, your abstraction or cubism to bear on New Zealand regionalism?
Yeah, again, I think it's that collage thing that I was talking about. Like, how do you create collage without attaching different materials onto the canvas? Can you do it through paint or through art history? And I think there's a butting up of European or American modernism with New Zealand regionalism, with contemporary queer painting, and it's all happening simultaneously at different times on the canvas. So I think, yeah, it's not so much of a putting my cubist abstraction onto regionalism. I think it's kind of letting those two things speak to each other, because it then talks about what does it mean to be a painter who's still residing and making work in New Zealand on this land, and like, what is the responsibility of you being an artist or a Pākehā artist on this land? And then also, like, but we're still always looking towards the world and the overseas and these kind of centres of art making as being at the top of the hierarchy, or like much better than us or more expansive than us. And I think I'm always thinking, well, is that kind of bullshit, really? Like, can this be, now that with the internet and with the connection that we experience on a day-to-day level, do we need to still be looking to them? And
perhaps I have a bias, but I think New Zealand painting stands up against anything on the international stage.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's, we also, a lot of us are very lucky in that we're working in all over the world too. So I think there's something, I'll always be drawn to histories of New Zealand painting. A lot of it is just so playful, which I love as well. Like, I feel like we get away with a lot maybe down here. Yeah.
Well, that's not a bad transition to a quote from the Thirsty Work catalogue, so from 2021. And that quote is, "It's possible that these are failed attempts at abstracting representation or of representing abstraction." So there's been a steady move from abstract to representational work, it feels like, through the years, and especially in the last couple of years. So why? How has that grown? How have you grown closer to representational or figurative work?
Well, I always made it in the past. I made it at art school, and I was encouraged to do it less because whatever I was making was pretty smutty and pretty provocative.
Yeah.
So it could be read as a return, but also I think now I think about abstraction and representation so differently, and I just don't even think that they are exclusive of, or they're not even polar opposites. I think they're one and the same, or they're kind of like these constructed hierarchies, and they've been placed there for a reason, for a certain set of people. And I think about them in a kind of more non-binary approach, which always makes people laugh. It's kind of a ridiculous thing to say, but I just, now, for a few years, I've been kind of thinking, you can't really have one without the other. Like, in order to have one, you need, like, in order for something to be abstract, you need some sense of representation to kind of point it out. But even now, as I talk about it, the language is failing me. So I think I've become more comfortable in making things that are recognisable forms, because I just don't see them as that different to abstraction.
Yeah, it's quite fluid. The two, if we consider them two, are quite fluid.
Yeah. I just think so many things have changed. Why are those things still like huge stakeholders in the painting world? Like, whether somebody is abstract or representational, I think so much of it is just marketing an artist to people. And so the last show, Murmurs, I think I was kind of at a point where sometimes you don't know what your work is about or what it is that... It's really hard to articulate my work sometimes, and I don't know where it's going, but then...
It's hard to articulate it to yourself?
Yeah, but then I trust that the audience is going to be smart enough to pick up on what is happening, and then, like, I just trust innately that that will happen, even if I don't know what is going on. But I was kind of at a point where I was like a bit sick of having to constantly or just not sick of it, but frustrated with how much you have to unpack paintings all the time to the audience. And I think someone I was talking to was like, this is a very recent thing where everything has to be kind of become very digestible and like sold to an audience and explained. And I think I'm now realising I'm quite protective of illegibility and like artworks that we can't recognise or we don't understand, and letting those artworks still have a place. Yeah.
Perhaps that reflects then why this most recent show, Murmurs, feels like it switches or toggles between abstract and figurative work quite a bit. So it almost feels like with that show there's a bit of a reset or redefinition going on of where the practice is going next.
Yeah, that's intentional. I think there is a sense of that everybody's had of, is this of what's to come next?
Yeah.
And I kind of am I think that's the first time I've had a show which talks more about the future than the past, which I think was strategic, because that's kind of where I am in life at the moment. I've been painting for 15 years, which isn't as long as a lot of your other guests, but,
but
that is
enough.
Actually a really long time.
Yeah.
And I never thought that would actually be a possibility, because it was just seemed... becoming a female painter was just not, I just didn't think it was a career that I could do. Or I thought I would have had kids by this stage, and I'm lucky to have just been able to focus on my practice. So, yeah, I'm at this stage where I don't really, I think I'm moving, I'm shifting from wherever I've been. And I'm, so I think maybe that's what people are picking up on.
It's funny, looking at that show for me, it almost feels like a palate cleanser or something.
Yeah.
Again, no painting pun intended.
But that's good.
Yeah, it feels like you're resetting or...
Yeah. Also, I was travelling a lot in the last year, so I did a residency in New York and Brooklyn, and then I went to Europe and London and saw a lot of shows. And I think... I thought it was going to be this trip where I kind of found myself, because I was already lost by that stage. I've been lost for like 2 years. And
what do you mean you've been lost?
I don't have as much of a clear sense of who I am as a painter anymore as what I used to. Yeah, I think I...
This is a byproduct problem of being 15 years into the practice.
Maybe, because I think when you're emerging, you kind of like... For me anyway, there was a lot of work around convincing my audience of what I was interested in and what I was doing. And now it feels like maybe I'm more established. I'm kind of breaking those things apart and questioning, because when you have a painting practice, you're constantly looking for problems to solve. Like, it's like you invent problems that you then have to solve. And I just think it's really normal for painters to not draw blanks, because you have to keep painting, but to have moments where you don't necessarily have as much of a clue of what the work is about. I've spoken to a lot of particularly older painters about that, and they said it's something you have to get really comfortable with, because it's always going to happen. Yeah. So I'm not lost in a sense that I'm still making, but I think I'm questioning why and what and how I'm making it. And I think that's kind of more exciting than it is daunting, because it means that it's going to keep refreshing itself and it's going to keep changing, whereas I'd hate to keep making the same paintings over and over again. Like, the thought of it is just excruciating to me. Yeah.
That probably flows quite nicely into this quote from the McCann House residency essay that Julie Waite wrote. And that quote from Julie is, "Her carefully crafted paintings may slip between the poles of homage and irony, but in her uneasy abstraction and hectic attitude towards form, I find certain and knowing sincerity." I certainly see the sincerity and irony, but increasingly the explicit like parts of your painting to me make you seem like this master comedian. Like, you're somewhere between Joan Rivers and Hannah Gadsby in how you want to express in painting. So, and by that I mean, you know, it's really smart, but you do want to be funny as well, right?
Yeah.
To perhaps, you know, land work with maximum impact.
Yeah. Well, comedy and, well, I don't know about comedy, but humour is really important to me. I don't know how those things are different. I just think I just don't know enough or digest enough comedy to really know what I'm talking about in that regard. But humour has always been a part of my work, a part of who I am. And when I was at Elam and not knowing what I was doing, I would always go back to making comics. So that's always an underpinning in the paintings. But I...
Going back to making comics because they're such a straightforward proposition both in making and consuming?
Yes. So I comics in terms of like zines. So I was really interested in distributing ideas cheaply and kind of moving outside of a gallery space. And also bookmaking's in my blood, my DNA.
Yeah.
So it was partly that as well. But they were all autobiographical comics. So they were just like day-to-day things that happened that I thought was weird or hard or funny. So that's the humor side. I think it's harder for me to make humorous paintings. Sometimes it happens. There's a work in Murmurs, which I think is kind of funny. The one with the flutes.
The Yeah Trio.
But then people have straight out told me, like, it's not funny, it's beautiful. And I'm like, well, that's kind of nice. I like...
but damn.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, there's always, like, it's well known that there's a lot of seriousness to humour and comedy. And that's why it's effective. So, I don't think I see those two things as, like, exclusive from or polarised from one another.
Yeah.
But I would love to be able to make funnier artwork. I just don't think I'm a professional comedian. So
yeah, so if it comes, it comes.
If it comes, it comes, but I can't force it. So, yeah, I also like having works that certain people love. And, you know, like I do have an audience which is a lot older because there's facets of New Zealand historical painting in my work. So, like... there's people that hang my works beside an Illingworth in their house, and I'm like, wow, that's like that's the best. They might not necessarily be into the funny, like smutty, cheeky works. They might like the kind of more serious works. So I think it's not like I'm trying to make sure there's something for everybody, but I do, maybe from being a musician, I'm fascinated by audiences and how you can have a range of people in your audience. Yeah, it's not just speaking to one demographic or one type of person.
Do you then consider, so thinking about that audience, like where paintings end up, do the works end up being queer cultural ambassadors, you know, populating worlds that you know, you might not as a painter exist in, but the paintings end up going into? So do you think of them out there, probably not so quietly depending on the work, hanging on walls, sparking conversations?
Yeah, again, it's that kind of Trojan horse thing, I think, that sometimes when I see them in houses, I'm like, that is crazy that person bought that work, because for me, that work is this. But it's kind of cool that they have something else, they have another relationship with that work. I actually find it really heartbreaking thinking about works out in the world, and I try and block it out in a way, and when I see them in people's houses when I don't know the person, you know, it's a collector or someone, it actually makes me feel really sad, because I think I have a weird relationship with paintings and that I think they're like my babies.
So it's difficult to let them go.
Yes, really difficult. Like, usually I'm pretty upset when they leave the studio. And then you kind of, you say goodbye to them and they're showing and then you never see them again. And it's like, yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't know why I get emotionally attached to them. I think it's like, people have done so much writing about the energy that is invested or that is transferred to paintings, so maybe it's that. But then people always say, you know, like we're looking after it, or it's in a good place, and I'm like, that's awesome. I don't make like heaps and heaps of work. Like I don't generate tons of work. I generate work through layers, so there'll be up to 12 layers in different works within a painting itself. So you have like months and months and months with this painting. But I think, yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's an energy thing, but it's also like you can see when an artist is really close to their work or there's something really invested in the work. And it's obvious when people aren't, right? Like there's a lot of phony work out there. So I would hope, like, works don't really leave the studio until they have that kind of feeling about them for me.
So you're hoping they end up in the right place?
That's not up to me. Yeah, that's really not up to me. I think it's really good when they end up in a collection and they can be viewed by the public. That's always the best outcome.
In a collection, a public collection.
A public collection, yeah, sorry, a public collection. Yeah, but when they're in people's houses, I think they are good in domestic spaces, but yeah, I separate myself from that completely, so I don't really think about it that much.
to dull the pain.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Of them leaving you.
Yeah.
Looking at some of the paintings, especially more recent work, I feel like I feel like I see this universal theme of human entanglement. So especially in a literal sense. Mm. But is there a hint there of you thinking about what human relationships are, you know, beyond, say, sexual entanglement that we see in the work?
Mm. Yeah, I think I've shifted in the last year from trying to make work sort of dealing with queerness to thinking more about eroticism in art and how ancient that is. Like, it's been going on forever, right? And how kind of it's more universal in a way than queerness, I think. For the works to have bodies in them and to be like, oh, but they're queer, is a little bit alienating for some people, but I think the work has always kind of been more interested in desire in a broad sense, but eroticism, which is something that a lot of people have access to. But I just love painting bodies. I love painting round forms. Mm. I think the works have always felt or looked like bodies without bodies even being in them.
Even the most abstract work?
Definitely, maybe more so.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. I think entanglement, I hadn't actually thought about that word, and it's so, like, it's almost quite...
It
feels not violent, but it feels quite, like, intense, that word, eh?
I certainly don't mean it to sound negative, which is what it implies.
No, I'm not taking it negatively, no. I think it's, I think there's something about kind of... there's always been symmetry in my work and linear works. I'm very technical, I'm a bit of a nerd. I use a lot of templates and stencils in my work.
Mm.
And often I will kind of freehand things and things just end up looking like bodies because they're made with the body. Yeah, I'm not sure if I can answer that question. I think that is actually, you know, there's some questions where the work is actually answering the question and I just don't know if I'm capable of doing that.
Yeah.
But I also think it's something that's still opening up to me as well. Like, I haven't really figured it out, and maybe it's not supposed to be figured out.
Shall I ask you this again in another 15 years into the practice and see?
That would be great.
See where we've got to.
Yeah. I'll be so embarrassed of what I said now. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to talking about art history for a moment. We've covered some of this ground already, but it's almost impossible to look at your work and not think of lots of art history references because of the cubism, especially. Yeah. So what is your relationship with art history? Like, presumably you are quite cognizant of it working.
Yeah. Who isn't? Who makes art that isn't? Have you talked to a painter yet that is not interested in art history?
I don't think I have.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think...
Or maybe a more accurate question then is, where do you think you fit into art history? Or how are you trying to fit into art history if you're thinking about it so much?
I think I've always been suggesting an alternative art history, not the one that we've been fed. I'm deeply sceptical of that, but I think I also treat art history maybe like a music fan in like a record collection. I think all my books and my artists are like collecting records or something, and there are painters or artists who I'm drawn to like I would be a pop star. And they're a real kind of... I have real heroes. So, like, when people ask me questions about what painting would you ideally have in your house, it's easy for me.
Which I am going
to
ask
you. Which it's easy for me to answer that because I have these real heroes that I always come back to. Kind of like people are with musicians, I guess. Everyone has their favourite
musician. So are they more likely to end up in work?
Yeah, they're all through the work. Yeah, like the work is, what did Julia say? Homage.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think of art history in a very kind of clunky, obvious way, maybe, where I'm not afraid of it appearing and being obvious who I'm looking at, because I'm actually threading that in like collage. And that goes back to what I was saying before about thinking about collage in a different way. I think I started thinking about collage as a way of utilising art history, but also drawing out art histories that weren't included in art, in the art history that we know.
The alternative you're talking about.
Yeah, the alternative art history. But in saying that, I'm still like a huge fangirl for people like Francis Bacon and Georgia O'Keeffe, who were massive, but conveniently they were both queer as well. So I think that's why I'm a fan. That's a big question. Yeah. How do you feel about art history? My challenge to you would be like find an artist who isn't.
Yeah.
Because it kind of has to be supporting every single practice in a way. But I think I, out of a lot of people, I do it in the most, one of the more obvious ways.
Mm. Although that said, Imogen, looking at Quiet Motel, so show from 2022.
Yeah.
That looks less identifiable in terms of art history reference. It feels like you were stepping away from those more obvious art history references.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that show was made in a difficult time. It was made during the 2021 lockdowns, mostly. And it was made for Whangarei Art Museum, which is where I was born, and it was my first show, first and maybe only show in Te Tai Tokoro. So I think I was trying to make a show that was a real like gift to Northland, like a love song, I wanted to kind of thank Northland for like raising me in the first few years of my life. So that show really does exist in a kind of vacuum, which isn't necessarily tied to any other body of work.
Hmm. Which is why it might feel a little more independent from artistry, quote unquote.
Yeah. Also, I think I go between making shows in public institutions which are really well thought out kind of exhibitions. Like, I think about all the different elements and how they all work together.
Well, that show feels like it has such a strong single narrative to
it. Yes, yeah. And that gallery was a real challenge to work in. The lighting wasn't great, so I was like, finally, I'll make my nocturnal show, because there was hardly any lighting in the gallery. And then I go between making kind of well thought out shows to then making like more individual works that I might show at a dealer gallery or something like that.
Which is what maybe Murmurs feels more like.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't need to have this kind of overall like theme or story arch of like a show that I might show in a public institution. Yeah. Mm. But I still think there is art history in there. I think I was in between being in New York the first time and the second time as well, so I was looking at a lot more contemporary painting rather than painting from the past, which is what I've still continued to do. But yeah, that kind of, what was it? It was quite like, it was still cubisty, but there were a lot of figures, and I don't know, I'd be interested to hear why you find it's not referencing art history as much.
It seemed like such a firm step away from abstraction and cubism to something far more representational. It just felt like you really removing yourself or divorcing yourself from what was a little more obviously references to art history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't... I think the only thing I can think of is that maybe because it was created in a vacuum, which was a lockdown.
Mm.
So there wasn't as... like, paintings change so much when you're not engaging with other people and talking to other people about what you're doing. So it might have just been that, to be honest, yeah.
Well, that's probably a good point to move into talking about process.
Yeah.
So always want to know where work starts. So conceptually for a start, if not the technical. So where does work start for you?
Right from ordering the canvas and then stretching the canvas, priming the canvas. I always think about all of that as a huge part of I'm really interested in materials. I love pigments. I'm a huge nerd when it comes to colour theory. So right down to the materials, which are all mostly ready-made materials. I don't really make anything. And then I don't construct the canvas or the stretcher, but then the work, I would consider that all being part of the work.
Yeah, so you mentioned before substrate being as important as the paint itself.
Yeah, and maybe that's because I have a sculptural background as well. And I think I'm still interested in acknowledging a painting as an object. And then I think after that, I used to always start from a place of not knowing what they were going to look like. Like, they had to start, and the way they started, there would be none of that left by the end of it, so the painting would disappear over time until it became something else. But now I'm kind of more free in terms of drafting something up first and then editing into it. But I'm still, when people come into the studio, say, like, this painting that's hanging on the wall right now, which is a dud.
So, for listener context, we're sitting in your studio out in West Auckland.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this work. You're considering this work a dud?
Yeah, it's a painting the same scale as the works in Murmurs. And it was intended for Murmurs, but it didn't work out. And it's for several reasons. It's basically a painting of a spanner.
Yeah.
And when I painted it, that show has a lot of close-ups of objects that some of them are recognisable, some of them aren't so much. And I wanted to do a tool. So a tool did end up in the show, but it's a hammer. But a lot of people can't identify that as a hammer.
I didn't identify it.
Yeah. But this one, a spanner felt too much like, I was like, I don't know if it's possible to paint tools without referencing Lee Lozano, who is probably the most well-known for painting tools. And that artist is too close to who I am I didn't feel comfortable putting it out in the world, so now it's sitting on my studio wall until I figure out how to paint over it. So
is it taunting you?
Yeah, I hate it. But I think I like that I can be around works that I am not close to and really struggle with, and I'm pushed to kind of get them to this place of they work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, every time somebody comes into the studio, there's a work like that, and they go, oh, that's great. And I go, well, it's not going to be there, like, in a week. So each work just kind of has to almost have this, like be overturned and become something completely different until it's there. So that would be my process. I think I do about 60% looking and 40% making.
Hmm.
So I think that's what painting is to me. It's not just, it's a real passive making as well, where you have to be really good at seeing and looking at things and waiting for the right moment.
So looking at what?
Looking at the work and looking for indicators of what you should do next.
Mm.
But that's just the way that I work. Obviously some people would draft something up and then fill it in and know where things are going to go and how they work, and they apply the same formula for each work. But for me, each work has its own set of rules or parameters. So if I have to make a show quickly, I'll allow enough time to be looking at the work so that it gets enough space around it so that I don't miss any cues, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because if you're working on paintings all the time, you kind of miss seeing moments that appear and need to be focused on a lot more.
Mm.
So yeah, I think the art of painting is not just the physical manifestation of paintings, it's the kind of allowing paintings to have space around them so that then you can work with what's there right in front of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to step away from work that didn't work, this piece that we're looking at in the studio, to ones that have, you've said, especially of some favourite work, that sometimes you can't figure out how the hell you made them, despite best efforts to. Is that a reflection of, you know, a balance of planning versus, you know, real-time exploration and intuition?
Yep, it's definitely that. I think it's also a huge amount of risk-taking, like being willing to lose everything in order to gain something.
Mm-hmm.
Having ideas of painting that have nothing to do with my practice, like looking at a lot of painters who make work that is nothing like mine, and then sometimes standing in front of my canvases and thinking, huh, maybe I'll try that, and then it kind of does something and I'm like, whoa, that's weird. So like having the kind of a really objective way of working outside of myself, like bringing other people or other ways of painting into the practice that aren't just about me. Like, yeah, I am always trying to take risks or trying to challenge myself to not be myself.
So trying to channel others as much as your experience?
Yeah, definitely. And that goes back to the homage thing. But I think that's why I wouldn't know how the hell I made them.
So it's not that you're just forgetful?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not that. It's that I think several people in your these interviews have talked about the zone that you kind of go into when you're making, and it's like time slips away and you forget everything and you come out of it and hours have passed. I don't think I'm that kind of in that kind of a space. I'm always kind of multitasking and doing other things, so I do remember a lot of what goes on, but there are moments of decision making that kind of slip away from you, and then when you sit back and look at them, you're kind of perplexed about what got you to that point of making that decision or taking that risk. Yeah.
It must give you, though, a ton of confidence, even if you don't know how you've managed to produce some works, that your process is going to get you there in the end.
Yeah, I think for me, trust is a huge part of my practice. I think, and what's gotten me to where I am now, really, is that for me, I have to trust that I'll get there and that everything will be okay.
Yeah.
And if I don't know what I'm doing or I don't know how to do it, ultimately the painting is what will lead me there. Yeah. And I think that is a really common way that painters think. I think they kind of treat their painting practice or their art quite separate from themselves in this kind of spiritual way. Like, I've watched the Wham documentary on Netflix the other night, and even George Michael talked about the way that he wrote songs was like the songs that are his most famous songs, like Careless Whisper. He was like, those songs always existed, he just had to find them. And I think I love that way of thinking about art, that it's separate from you and you're just the person that makes it. Like, you're kind of this employee of the practice. Yeah. So, I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, but I think it does. Yeah. Something that feels like another little shift. We talked about, you know, Murmurs maybe being a palette cleanser or exploring new ideas.
Yeah.
A specific painting in that show, Trio, which we've talked about briefly already,
yeah,
that feels like quite an outlier in that show, not least all the way that you're managing paint on the support.
Yeah.
Like, it almost looks like you're painting wet on wet in some of that, like pulling some colours into other colours. So is that a bit of an experiment in going somewhere new? Do you even know that yet?
Yeah, I think that technique that I used is quite specific to Trio because of the subject matter that I'm exploring, which is, for the listeners, two people embracing, and one is holding two flutes and the other is holding one flute.
Yeah. Which, by the way, listeners, again, in the Instagram post there'll be an image of this painting for you to reference.
But, yeah. So that image initially started out as flat planes. So it is the most cubist work in the show. It's the way that it's split. They're not... the depiction of those forms is utilising not a grid, but like a cute... they're all cut up. And I think they were quite flat at the beginning, and it didn't really work because, for me, that in order for that painting to read as funny, for me, it needed to have a sense of expressionism or something that was quite self-important, like bolshy, like... it needed to bring in a painting history that had a kind of earnest, like, seriousness about it, which for me was more, yeah, expressionism. Whereas if it had been flat colours, it would just be a one-liner funny painting. But like I said, people disagreed that it was just funny and said it was beautiful, and I think that's purely because of the way that it's painted in that style, where the paint is really seductive because you get, with that technique, it's like a dragging technique where you're pulling a lot of medium over pigment, so you get the nice thing that I love that pigments do when they're pure pigments is they really butt up against each other, so they hold their own ground, but then they slightly blend, which is, there are so many seductive things that paint can do. Like, it's a really, people just really respond to it, right?
Yeah.
It does these, you can do these little tricks that people love. So I think that's why I employed that technique. Whether it will go into the future, I'm not sure, because I'm always skeptical of recreating works and being like, that works, I'll just make it again, because that seems like quite a commercial way to work. So if it needs to come up again, I would utilize it. If anything, I would work on it and make it a lot better, because for me, it's not quite there yet. But I was not even going to put that work in the show. Like, it was a real, like, what? Like, when my dealers came to the studio, my art dealers came to the studio, they just laughed and were like, what is that? And I was like, yeah. And so I just chucked it in the truck to go to the gallery, and I was like, it can always just sit in the stock room. Like,
this is your careful curation.
Yeah,
you chucked it in the truck.
Yeah. we don't need to put it in the show. It probably won't work. It's really different to the rest of the work. But then I worked out that I could hang it in a way where it could speak to the show.
Yeah.
So I'm glad, that I did.
Yeah, I think it's a killer painting.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's just those works, like, I just don't know if you can recreate them.
Mm.
Yeah, they're just so special.
Mm. Well, you just touched on something that this is your first quote that I'm going to throw back at you. Balancing depth with flatness is a challenge for me. What is the balance that you're wanting to achieve? Like, why do you need, you know, one and the other?
Well, as you were saying that, I was thinking, I deal with dichotomies so much. Before I was talking about representation and abstraction not being opposite, and then this kind of plays into that as well. Flatness has, I think I was trained that it was opposed to depth. I think it's a nice challenge to have both simultaneously, especially when you're using a medium like acrylic, which is naturally opaque and quite flat. But I think maybe it's like quite a philosophical part of my life, is that when I was growing up, it was, I was terrified about being gay. Like, I really didn't want to be gay, because I didn't want to live outside of the life that I had been encouraged to have. And even though I was born in 85, I think that was also a challenging time to be born in New Zealand, because HIV and AIDS was, like, you know, that's when it first came to New Zealand that year. So, like, within my lifetime, that has overshadowed being gay in New Zealand, and it made it really hard growing up, because it just, even though, yeah, it was hard. I didn't want to be this thing that was seen as bad or, like, not acceptable. So I tried to work out a way, I think, subconsciously, of being not straight passing, but, like, I'm good enough. Like, even though I'm gay and I'm a freak, I'm good enough and I'm really good at these things.
Yeah.
So I think I've always tried to hold different values simultaneously.
So that's that contradiction, as you talk about balancing depth and flatness.
Mm.
It doesn't sound like you're actually just talking literally about a painting.
No, I don't think I am. I think I'm talking about, yeah, I think I've grown up with really complex people, as most people do. You know, your parents and your family are really complex, and it's ideal in life if you can learn that there's reasons why people are complex, and there's reasons why they affected you badly or well, and there's also stuff behind that, and you can't just decide who somebody is or what something is based on how you see it. There's always something behind it, and I think that's easily applied to paintings as well, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It's a layered product, so you're always going to be looking through mediums or materials which light is going through layers, and it's like, it's kind of a nice metaphor for like, people often say that painting is a metaphor for life and living, and it's hard to talk about that. I think I feel like I need more backup to talk about that kind of stuff, but flatness and depth are, like, two foundational qualities of painting.
Yeah.
Like, formally, anyway, and I think they can be, philosophical as well.
Because two works that I think in a painting sense, work really well in terms of balancing depth and flatness is Charlie's Bar from 2016.
Yeah.
And I think a personal favourite of mine, Stoned Fruit, so 2018.
Mm.
So how do you resolve trying to achieve that balance between depth and flatness personally and in a painting maybe? Because it sounds like the two are actually inseparable for you.
Mm. Personally, lots of therapy. Yeah, I think there's also similarities between having a kind of therapeutic practice and painting. They're both, I mean, some people think painting is therapeutic. I don't find it therapeutic at all. I think it's hard work. It can be really pleasurable, though. Yeah, how do I achieve flatness with depth? I mean, I think, like I said, I've chosen a medium which is naturally flat and opaque, so I will always be working against that to create depth. That is the most straightforward way of having both of those things or dealing with both of those things. Depth. I also think there is a lack of skill in my work, if I'm to be honest. I think because I didn't study painting, I never learned how to paint really like hyperreal paintings.
This is the shocking confession in this interview. You're not a very good painter. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I always say that I'm not a very good painter.
Mm.
But I don't think good painters necessarily make good paintings. Like, there's so much bad painting out there by people who are technically really good at painting. Like, look at, and same goes with music. Like, look at punk music. They're not necessarily good at instruments. Like, Malaria, like you were talking about before, they weren't good musicians necessarily, but
I think some of my favourite music is made by terrible musicians.
Totally. Yeah. So I think that there's a bit of that as well, is that I'm kind of limited in some ways, but I can play to my strengths.
Mm.
I just don't think, I also will be first to admit that I don't think all the paintings are very good, or like there are always ones that I'll look at and be like, that is a complete failure. I can't believe I put it out into the world. But yeah, I think the lack of skill would be why flatness would come back and why depth would not be present, because I think, yeah, I just don't, sometimes I think I lack the ability to create depth, or I'm a one-trick pony, but maybe I'm being too hard on myself.
I think you probably are, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about colour as well and how you think about colour. So another couple of works that we'll reference, Forecast Fanta from 2017, and Apricot Burgundy from 2018. And those two works especially seem like a couple of examples where your colour combinations can be quite jarring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're certainly not natural, and God knows Fanta is not natural.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and are you wanting to sometimes, you know, create that unnatural, abrasive or jarring experience with colour?
Yes. Yeah, although I don't actually see those works as that jarring, but I've been told that they are. I think, again, I grew up with a lot of colour. Dad's books were always cloth-bound and, like, these quite garish colours. He was really into colours of the 60s. I love colour so much. Like, I just feel like being a painter, you have the access to the most beautiful colours, why not utilise them? And I feel like we've not grown up with a lot of colour in New Zealand. It's very green and grey.
Yeah.
So if you have the opportunity to create colour, why not do it? So those works that you're talking about, they're mostly like really intense cadmium orange and magenta and, quinacridones. I'm also always playing with artificial and natural pigments.
Mm.
So I'm like really interested in artificial pigments that were created in a lab that aren't necessarily mined from the earth, and what they can do and how they affect your eyes, given how much we're looking at screens at the moment. I think paintings have a lot to contend with.
Yeah.
So if you're able to employ colours which kind of appear synthetic but have this like organic quality to them as well, because they're sitting on a natural surface and the light is, I don't know, it's kind of relieving. It's a relief to look at a painting compared to a screen, especially if it has texture. So yeah, those are all the things that I'm kind of thinking about when I'm employing colour. It's also just I don't wear a lot of colour, and I don't surround myself with a lot of colour. It's something that I really enjoy making, though. It's so lush.
Yeah.
It's so lush.
Well, lush is probably a great word to talk about the colour palette of Quiet Motel.
Mm.
And if I pick on one work, especially for ease of listener reference, so Moths, which again, another favourite of your work of mine,
mm-hmm.
and those deep violet and blues that are in that work, like looking at those, how did you come up with those? Like, are they some combination of, like you've just talked about synthetics, so is modern ultramarine blue in there somewhere, and are you mixing a few colours to get to those?
Yeah, no, it's a lot of, I think when I was in the lockdown, I just did research into how to create nocturnes, because I had gone into lockdown thinking about works that were created. It sounds really dramatic, but I was thinking about works that Frances Hodgkins made throughout the First and Second World Wars, because she unfortunately lived and worked through both. And a lot of those works were nocturnes, because for some reason or other she was painting or working at night, or I think art historians have talked about what the kind of mood that they create. I mean, it was so hard for her at that time. I think in the Second World War, she was also losing her eyesight. So I was like, I wonder if I could make nocturnes. And so I looked into the technical way to construct a nocturne, which you would think that you would just choose your colours and where you go, but it's actually a way of working that is quite three-dimensional. So again, my sculpture background, where they need to be constructed in a way where they almost feel like they're backlit. So the light should be coming through layers of vivid, transparent colours. So Moths is a good example, because a lot of the colours are underneath, the bottom layers are fluoro colours that are then covered in layers and layers of ultramarine blue.
To get them to glow.
Yeah, and then kind of there is some lightness over top, but there is barely any white used in the painting. It's all fluorescent. So they have this, when you see that work in person, it does have this glowing effect. It's not tonally rendered in a way that you would another kind of painting where you'd go dark to light. It's light coming from within, which is, it was a really amazing way to paint that I hadn't done before, but it's not a way that I would then utilise throughout the rest of my work.
Yeah, they're all phenomenal paintings in that work especially.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
But also I think by the end I was so sick of using ultramarine, cobalt blue, transparent violet. Like, they are very cool, challenging colours. Yeah, but I mean, people always ask about colour, but it's like, it's colour is really personal, and it's kind of like in the work it's the most fashionable for me. Like, it changes with every season in a way. So the colours in the most recent show, Murmurs, were there were a lot of phthalo blues and like sky colours and earth, and people really responded to that as well, because it wasn't so jaunty and like acidic as the past colours have been.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of interested in maybe manipulating the audience with colour. I think it's one of the luxuries that you have as a painter to affect the audience, is colour, is always going to be colour.
Well, there's also always going to be scale, and you work across quite a range of scale, like anything from, I don't know, smallest works might be 200 by 200 up to, what, 15 by 15? Maybe larger even?
Bigger, yeah. Like two and a half by three kind of thing, yeah.
So how does scale define work, or does the work you have in mind determine what scale it's going to be?
I usually choose scale in regards to a space that they've been exhibited in.
So the space comes first?
Space comes first, yeah. If I'm working in the studio and I'm not working towards a space, there'll often be a similar type scale, because they're usually anything from like a kind of A4 size to a A2, because that's kind of manageable and But I find, I wonder often if people want to talk about scale a lot in regards to a female painter, because it's honestly, like, I'm not saying like you're sexist or anything like that, but I'm saying like people do find it kind of fascinating that a woman can work on a large canvas, and I think that's so funny because
you mean there's some assumption in the background that they wouldn't be capable of it, and somehow they've achieved this miracle of working in a large 100%.
Because you think about the history of painting and you think about the access that women have had to painting, and it is only very recent history, and like when women first started being able to paint, they were encouraged to paint small scale still lifes. You know, when you go into the Hocken collection, it's all of the female painters' paintings are of small still lifes on like paper, watercolour. And so I think the history or the progression of women painting changed rapidly, and those abstract expressionist painters, they kind of like were the game changers really in terms of scale. But it's still something that I think there's a hangover of talking about it. I struggled to separate the scale question from gender. Yeah, because then you start talking about the physicality and the like the monumental nature of the work.
Art history is layering over scale as well.
Always, yeah. It would be nice to be able to, I'll just say it would be nice to be able to paint large all the time, but it's just not, it's not a possibility for me yet. And I think they'd all end up just sitting in storage, to be honest. So, as a way to kind of like the zine idea of like distributing ideas and getting things out there, it sometimes just makes sense for me to make smaller paintings.
Yeah.
And I quite like it. It's harder to make smaller paintings.
There's a pragmatism to it.
Yeah, always. It's much harder to make small work than it is big for me. Yeah. There's something nice about being able to utilise your whole body to make a work. But when you're using your wrist, it's I just find that really hard. Yeah.
So, final question, Imogen, that I'm asking everyone. If you were to remove any limit of budget, or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work, you know, would you love to live with? And why?
I kept only coming back to one artist, and it's not going to be a surprise, unfortunately, because this artist is Georgia O'Keeffe. I think I would own one of her works, and I think she just always comes back. Like, I always go back to her for some reason, and it's I've got lots of heroes and lots of artists that I'd love to own their work, but there's something really magical about her paintings, and I think the way that she also navigates contrasts and dichotomies simultaneously, like, and I also think her practice is like art history really mucked it up, like they really got it wrong.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of layers that can be peeled back in her work, and there's a lot I could just stare at one of her works forever and still not know how or why she made it. And a lot of the work that I have at home is paintings that I find at op shops, and they're amazing, like they're incredible. People always go, oh, wow, who painted that? And I'm like, I don't know, I found it at an op shop. They're really good paintings. And I love having work in the house where I look at them and look at them and look at them, and I still don't know what was in a person's head when they were painting it. And
they are the best work,
And I think it makes it challenging for me to collect work by people I know or people who have been through the same university system as I have, because I think I can always figure it out. And I don't, I mean, that sound, probably sounds quite patronising. I still have a lot of admiration for a lot of painters who I've come up with and who I know. But, I think as a painter, I like to, for a work to constantly perplex me, particularly in the construction or the conception of it. And I still get that from O'Keeffe, and I think she changed modes over her life. Like, she had a long career, right? Like, she stopped painting when she was really old.
Yeah, like late 80s, right?
I thought it was 90. Like, maybe not 91, even right, yeah. Like, until she lost her eyesight.
Yeah.
So there's so much to choose from. Like, there's so yeah. many decades of work that I would choose from. But I would probably choose something that, for me, sits in a space of not being one thing or the other. It's kind of sitting in the middle of everything in this kind of like very ambiguous space that you can't pin down, you can't assign labels to. It's very like non-binary in every way imaginable, and yet it's kind of looks like it's something natural or organic that existed in the world already, like a seed pod or a flower that you picked up. It looks like it is made from nature.
I just
love her work so much. And I think there's no one else that compares to her for me.
Mm.
Yeah, and even in the way that she lived her life.
Yeah.
So I think that's it.
As always, thanks for listening. You have until the 7th of October to see Imogen's show Murmurs at Michael Lett Gallery in Auckland, or contact Michael Lett Gallery for available work. I also highly recommend the book titled Imogen Taylor, which presents selected works exhibited between 2011 and 2021, available from Michael Lett Gallery and selected outlets. This brings us to the end of season one of The Good Oil. A huge thanks to all the artists that have been kind enough to invite me into their studios over the last few months. It's been such a pleasure to be part of these conversations. But also thanks to you for listening. I really appreciate you lending the podcast your time and ears. The Good Oil will return with season two in late March 2024. Until then, please have a great spring and summer. Ka kite anō.